normally at Evensong, my homilies are fairly reflective, but today I'm making a change and have a fairly critical message. Well, we'll get there in a minute, but first of all, I want to acknowledge the beautiful surroundings that we are in, because with its prominent tower, its imitation Gothic windows, its steep roof and its distinctive outline, this building is instantly recognizable as a church. Enter the building as we have done, and to anyone familiar with churches around the world, that impression is only confirmed. But why here in the furthest reaches of the Pacific is the architecture of church buildings so determined by a tradition that developed in the British Isles? Why is it done in a style that has been developed in conjunction with many other European nations? And does the basic outline of churches not go back to public buildings in the late Roman Empire? What does all this have to do with our chair in New Zealand? Very little, some people say. And so also an architecture has been sought that expresses more of the local culture, whether it's through incorporating Maori elements or that specifically Kiwi feel of connection with nature, or maybe even a certain lack of permanence. At times, beauty has been created through this effort. At other times, aesthetical values are more debatable. Among the many considerations flowing into the liturgical divisions of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s that resulted in a New Zealand prayer book was the aim to have a truly local liturgy rather than one imposed from afar. The result, again, is largely beautiful and meaningful, but the notion that it is therefore the only liturgy fitting for New Zealand because it's far superior to all others, that also has arisen with that. Just a few years ago, a motion was passed by the General Synod of the Anglican Church in New Zealand that only specifically New Zealand liturgy would be allowed for most services, in particular communion services. Up to that time, liturgies from Anglican churches around the world could officially be used. Well, I have come across some weird and strange liturgies from other parts in the world, so the New Zealand option may seem a bit safer. But I have also come across some beautiful and expressive liturgies and would be sorry to lose them. The proposal by the General Synod had to be approved by the separate diocesan synods before it could be passed. In Tikanga Pākehā, three dioceses had rejected the proposal and three had approved it. I was in the seventh diocese, which had yet to decide and through its decision would make the decision for the entire Anglican Church in New Zealand. I was not prepared for the debate. The tone of cultural superiority displayed by some speakers was truly arrogant and crass. They said that other liturgies come from cultures that were not as liberal and progressive and therefore were backward. After what we have achieved here in New Zealand, we should not allow those less advanced liturgies back in. An argument was made that other societies have not caught up to modern notions of gender, for example, which is quite important in a New Zealand context. There was a concern that the theology in some other countries may be old-fashioned. There were three aspects in these arguments which stood out for me. One, the surrounding culture seemed to be more important than any faithfulness to the Christian message or the Bible in the liturgy. Culture trumps everything else. Two, there was a clear division between progressive or advanced cultures and the less advanced ones. Three, anything old was bad and the new is good. It seems that the progressive worldview in this case was alive and well in the church, maybe more so than any belief in actual Christianity. This resulted in a sense of cultural superiority. The apex of progress so far was the enlightened New Zealander. The backwards Africans could only be pitied. The proposal also limited severely the number of languages acceptable in the Anglican Church in New Zealand. English, Te Reo Māori, and a few Polynesian languages would have been acceptable. But communion services in Spanish, Swahili, or Korean could only have been celebrated unofficially. I'm happy to say that the proposal was defeated in that one diocese. In the Anglican Church of Aotearoa, New Zealand, liturgies from around the world and in other languages will still be able to be used in future. But the episode showed me that even here in New Zealand, our sense of being right and even better than others is quite strong. If we make our time and culture, our insights and understanding, the measure of all things, if we regard our cultural achievement as the one which has progressed far beyond all others, then we have to sooner or later clash with God's chosen people. That at least is the conclusion of theologians who had to reflect on how a people rushed headlong into disaster through its sense of superiority. Well, as you know, I come from that people as well, and maybe therefore am very sensitive to any excessive focus on our own culture as a better one. The notion that our own culture is more advanced or has progressed further makes implicit understanding of superiority even more dangerous. And yet, we as Christians maintain that there's one people that is chosen, through whom God has indeed blessed the world. But Israel is not set apart for its own honor, not because it is a nation that is better than others, but rather as the servant of God, the suffering servant at that. God sends it into the world, not as a mighty nation, but as politically impotent, yes, even an oppressed people, and as that it is a witness to God. Out of this people would come the one who fulfilled the mission of Israel, who indeed is the light of the world. While parts of the Old Testament were concerned with the internal questions of Israel, there's a strong sense of outward movement, of Israel being the one sent to the nations. There's also a strong sense of invitation of the nations being drawn towards God. The psalm that we read, Psalm 67, is part of that. It encourages the nations to be glad and sing for joy, for God cares for all people. Galatians 3, even in its complexity, it still maintains that people from all nations are drawn towards God, that through faith in Jesus Christ, they become children of God and part of the seed of Abraham. In other words, in Jesus Christ, the purpose of God through Israel has been fulfilled. In Jesus, the purpose of the law, which so defined Israel, is fulfilled. The invitation to the whole world is made real. Paul can therefore say that there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave or free, male or female, for we are all one in the Messiah Jesus. So are we no longer Kiwis or Germans, English or Nigerian? Are we no longer man or woman? Well, no, we still are all that. But that is no longer our primary identity. Rather, it is our life in Jesus Christ. That's why we can indeed say that Christ is the world's true light. For in Christ, we no longer need to be afraid of the other. Rather, we can see in them our beloved brothers and sisters, even more so if they are also in Christ. While we can value our own culture, our own roots, we can see that they are not the measure and apex of all things, but rather one way of being in the world which still falls short of the glory of God, but out of which we are all called to God's goodness and forgiveness. I hope, therefore, that we can accept the wisdom and insight of other Christians around the world, that we can appreciate their worship, even if the world around us regards them as less developed, as less advanced. For in Christ, we are indeed all one, and that's more important than our differences.